This is the Experience Points IndieCast, episode number 2 for the week of April 13th, 2011. Jump into the show, let me offer a quick program note. This week we're excited to present a conversation with Jason Rohr. Thankfully, Jason comes through loud and clear, but George and I had some microphone problems on our end. The whole show is still very listenable, but we wanted to warn you that our voices might not sound as melodious as you all are used to. But not to worry, next week everything will be back to normal. So with that, we hope you enjoy the show, and thanks as always for listening.
Welcome back, everybody. This is the Experience Points podcast. My name is Scott Juster.
I'm George Alvord.
We're the co-creators of ExperiencePoints.net, a website dedicated to the serious but not humorless analysis of video games and culture. And this week, we got a third chair on.
We do.
We have Jason Rohr. Jason, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, guys.
Jason is, I mean, if you listen to this podcast, read our website, probably recognize
the name.
We're going
on, yeah.
Yeah. Jason's independent game designer, developed many games, not only, you know, I guess not only game designer, I mean, you have a whole nother, previous career, right, of software and music engineering, stuff like that.
Yep, I used to do peer-to-peer stuff back in the day.
So, you know, digital renaissance man, I guess, is on his business card. Most recently, he released Inside a Star-Filled Sky. And you heard us actually talk about that last week on one of the independent games podcasts that we did.
Which means we can skip a lot of the framework of that game and just go right to the juicy parts.
We can, if you will, we can just zoom in into the game. But, you know, we wanted to have Jason on this week, ask him a few questions, pick his brain a little bit, mm-hmm. see how right or wrong we were about all the crap we were talking about his game. So we should get right into it. Yeah. Again, thanks for being on the podcast, Jason. We appreciate this.
Yeah. I'm happy to be here.
Okay. Where should we start, George? Because we got a lot of stuff here. I guess I would want to ask you specifically about Inside a Star-Filled Sky, because I feel like it's much more of a traditional game than some of your previous works, especially the last game, Sleep is Death. Is there a reason why you went traditional after going so kind of theoretical and experimental from your last game?
I mean, Sleep is Death is arguably not a game at all. you know, it's a tool, and you can certainly play games with it. And some people have used it to emulate, you know, known game systems like adventure game frameworks or whatever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's no success metrics of any kind, not necessarily a challenge of any kind built into it. You can tell stories with it that have challenges built into them, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I try to be a stylistic chameleon, I guess, as a designer. I'm always trying to change, always trying to think about what to do next, always just trying to think about what new direction to go off in. Mm-hmm. I don't want to like kind of get stuck in a rut, or, you know, people already try to pigeonhole me, you know, because of Passage or whatever shadow I'm standing under.
Mm-hmm.
I guess when I look at like the history of art, for example, expanding into the history of film and things like that, there's certain directors or artists who kind of seem like they kind of make the same movie over and over again, or they kind of paint the same painting over and over again throughout
mm-hmm.
their career.
Yeah.
And then there's these other people who are just like, I mean, I guess I think of like Picasso as a good example from the world of fine art. We're just, you know, I don't know, it was probably like every 10 years for Picasso or something, but, you know, changing all the time. Like, you look back at the history of Picasso and he's like, you see like The Boy with the Pipe or something. It looks totally different than anything he did later that he's well known for, you know. Like Lars von Trier is one of my favorite film directors, and he's constantly just doing crazy stuff. You know, just like, okay, now I'm going to film an office comedy with robotically controlled cameras, you know, after making, you know, a film about I don't even know what he did right before that. Some film where there wasn't even a set. It was sort of a play about the state of America or something in a very abstract with almost no props and no set and just actors on chalk outlines, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like totally jumping from one thing to another. Totally, it's almost like maybe boredom of the artist or something. Like, you know,
is it a coincidence that you chose like two of the craziest artists I could possibly think of?
I'm not a huge Picasso fan. I mean, you know, I've looked into his stuff. I mean, I'm not, you know, but I guess I would compare him to someone like Chuck Close, mm-hmm. Where, you know, you think of a Chuck Close painting. He's the guy who originally did these really large, like almost photorealistic headshot kind of portraits of people, where he must have used some sort of technology to blow it up to like a wall size picture of Philip Glass or something. And then over the years, his portraits started becoming more almost kind of impressionistic, where he's using these like concentric circles of color, big concentric circles of color all over the person's face to sort of, if you stand really far back, it kind of looks right. But as you get closer, you see these like all these spirals of color all over the place. And he basically, you know, if you look at a catalog of Chuck Close, you know, for the past like 25 years, he's been doing just that, right?
Yeah.
It's like if someone wants to buy a Chuck Close, that's what they want. It's not like they want to see him like branch off and do a sculpture, or, you know, branch off and do some kind of landscape painting or something. So I started to look at that. I'm like, why would you want to spend your life doing the same thing, you know, forever and ever, over and over and over like that? I mean, I'm not insulting Chuck Close. I mean, he's much more well-known than I am, and he's, you know, a great artist and so on. But I just feel like that's not, that kind of thing is not really for me. It's more, I'm more the type of guy who wants to, like, you know, I get bored very easily. I want to move on to something new very quickly after finishing something. I don't want to iterate and keep perfecting one kind of form or something like that.
Yeah. Do you feel like you've got a lot of pressure then to make something even more bizarre or more exhilarating than your previous games, just because people have all this recognition about your work?
Yeah, I definitely feel that, you know. Even after, like, Passage was my third game, but it was my first really well-known one. And that was like, wow, I don't know. I think it was the fall of 2007, so that's like going on like 4 years now or something. So even at right after Passage, with how much recognition it got immediately after it came out and so on, I was really feeling a lot of pressure even back then. I was like, oh my gosh, you know, how am I ever going to follow this one up, you know?
Yeah.
And then I guess I sort of get over that at some point and just do something, right? And then, so after Sleep is Death, I mean, Sleep is Death was a design that sort of swallows all other designs in a certain way. Because any sort of game you'd want to make about, like, characters or stories or a game about, you know, even if I wanted to make a game about my feelings about mortality and my relationship with my wife, which was what Passage was about.
Yeah.
If I set out to make that game today, I'd be like, oh man, I should just make a Sleep is Death story about that. You know, it's like, I can never do it justice because I can't have a real conversation in the game unless I do something like what Sleep is Death did. So after making Sleep is Death, it kind of like swallowed up all these possible game designs. You know, it's like any sort of topic I'd want to tackle that had human beings in it, it'd be like, well, this would really be better as a Sleep is Death story. So why do I even bother? So I guess that sort of sent me off into this totally different direction of, you know, so this abstract philosophical concept that didn't really have anything to do with people, you know, more just to do with our thinking about these kinds of, they're thinking about the universe or something like that, right? You know, there aren't recognizable characters of any kind in Inside a Starfield Sky. And it's not really about, I mean, some people say, well, I feel like I'm going down inside myself or I'm going inside dreams or whatever. I mean, it's sort of about that, but not...
Yeah.
Not in a very, you know, if you compare it, a lot of people compare it to the movie Inception, and Inception is about some of those same philosophical ideas, but it's, you know, all about the characters and how they, you know, their personal stories in that sort of philosophical space, right?
You spoke about this just a second ago, but when you were designing Starfield Sky, did it stem from trying to tell some kind of thematic story and then crafting the mechanics, or were you messing around with, you know, a shooter type situation and then thinking about the themes after you had nailed down how the flow of the game was going to be?
Yeah. So my design process always starts from the sort of theme or the sort of philosophical kind of thing that I want to explore and express. And then I design mechanics around that. That's been pretty consistent, you know, going all the way back through my entire catalog of stuff. I sort of feel like a lot of people in the video game world don't do it that way.
Yeah, I was going to say that same thing. It seems like a lot of people do the opposite.
BioShock, when I've read about BioShock, I've never met Ken Levine, mm-hmm. and You know, I don't know him personally or anything, but I've just read some interviews and stuff. And, you know, there's some stuff about the history of BioShock's development where it really feels like it was going to be a first-person shooter and it was going to have this kind of upgrade system and all these kinds of mechanical things in it very early on.
Mm-hmm.
And the setting and the themes were very different in some of their early thinking about it. You know, it wasn't going to be in an underwater city built by a, you know, a megalomaniac kind of guy. It was going to be on some island where scientific experiments had run awry. I mean, that's also, you know, the name BioShock kind of is a strange fit, right?
Yeah.
You know, I guess if I would call the game Rapture, or, you know, I don't know if I had to title it. But, you know, the BioShock title, I think, stuck from, you know, being a spiritual successor of System Shock. And then some of these earlier themes that it was going to tackle. So, you know, so kind of like having a game design set and then changing the theme halfway through seems like a very strange thing to do, especially if, you know, the game mechanics and the dynamics that stem from those mechanics are supposed to be this sort of expressive beating heart of the game, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I try to do it the other way. I try to, you know, think about what I'm trying to express, what I'm trying to explore, what ideas the game is supposed to sort of deal with, and then try to think of the best mechanics to deal with those things.
Has there ever been a time where you started really hashing out the mechanics and then realized, wow, this is saying something different from the themes that I was doing, and either had to scrap it or change the themes themselves?
I mean, the biggest example that sticks out most in my mind is way, way back, a long time ago, before Passage, I made a game called Cultivation.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so that's a game about conflict and compromise and kind of the balance between the two things, and about basically the thesis of the game is that, you know, sometimes what you stand to lose in the conflict is more than what you stand to gain by winning. You know, that's sort of like,
yeah.
That's sort of a thesis. And so I set up these dynamic systems in the game that, you know, as you play, I mean, there's nothing hard coded. It's just, I set up these systems to be balanced in such a way that as you play, you see those kinds of things play out. There's like artificial intelligence, intelligent units in the game that are basically symmetrical to you, and you're running around with them, making decisions about your gardening and planting stuff and harvesting stuff and deciding who to have relationships with and so on, and getting into little fights with them and so on over land disputes, essentially. So the game seemed pretty good. It was pretty much done. And I just felt like there wasn't enough conflict. And I also felt like whenever there was a kind of a big conflict or a lot of the units in the game were getting mad at each other or mad at you for doing something to them, there was no real consequence to it. It's like, they'd get really mad at you. They'd kind of squint their eyes at you. They'd stop giving you food in exchange, and they wouldn't mate with you and whatever, but it just didn't feel like there was enough. So then I added this new mechanic in very late in the development of the game, which was this poisoning mechanic where if somebody got really, really mad at you, they could come and like poison the plants that were in your garden and permanently turn a spot on the landscape black where nothing could grow there anymore. And I gave you as a player a poison verb as well, so you could run around and be an asshole and like go and poison everybody else's plants and starve them, you know. Sort of salting the earth, I guess, is essentially like what it was.
Yeah.
But it has this really strong visual representation of this black circle where the plant used to be on the landscape, and you can't plant anything there. And I think also if you're carrying food and you walk across it, the food you're carrying gets poisoned or something. There's some other stuff that goes along with it. So anyway, I just set that in. I just added this new mechanic. So if they get angry enough, they pass some angriness threshold, then they would start poisoning in retaliation. And that totally changed the dynamics of the game and ended up with this sort of new theme that emerged from it, which was this kind of ecological destruction. Because over time, as various conflicts erupted and died down, there'd be this sort of history of conflicts imprinted on the landscape as black spots. And as more conflicts erupted in different spots on the map, the landscape would slowly turn blacker and blacker to the point where there was no farmable land left, right? It was all poisoned. And there's remaining people running around looking for one little spot of land left and fighting over that one little last spot, you know, where they can still farm and still raise food to feed their starving children. And then you kind of pan back from the island and it's just all black and then everyone dies, right?
That exact thing happened to me when I was playing the game. It was just a vast wasteland at the end of my session. Right.
It's because you're a vindictive farmer, Scott.
Yeah.
So when I saw that happening, it was like, you know, this sort of epiphany moment for me. It was like, oh my gosh, that's really a weird, interesting, amazing, emergent kind of thing. And then that sort of changed what the game was about. It's kind of, you know, it added this ecological theme very late in the development. Mm-hmm. And then I did things to sort of deal with it and reinforce it and so on. I added a couple of extra mechanics because, you know, then it became like unbalanced in the other direction. Like, it's pretty much impossible to stop them from fighting among themselves and poisoning everything, even if you were being nice to everybody. So then I added another mechanic where you could lead. You could be so friendly to some of them that they'd want to start following you, and then you could lead them around and kind of break up fights that way. So then it added a whole new layer to the game to respond to, you know, this thing that had happened emergently. Then it became sort of a game about the environment as well, when I hadn't really set out to make it that like that,
mm-hmm.
which felt good to me. I mean, you know, it was something that I was thinking about at the time as well. So
happy emergence.
Yeah. Right, right. Less pessimistic than the previous rhetoric, I suppose.
I mean, I guess it also depends on what kind of game it is that you're designing. You know, because that game had a lot, just generally a lot of emergence in it, and it was all about sort of tweaking these AI parameters. But, you know, a game like Passage is much more cut and dried in terms of, like, what can emerge out of it. And so on paper, going from what was written on paper to actually design, you know, implementing the game and getting it running and playing it and watching people play it,
mm-hmm.
it was pretty straightforward. It was like, if you go back to my original notes on Passage, it pretty much describes the final game that shipped, you know.
Yeah.
Because there wasn't really anything to tune. You know, I guess you could tune the number of treasure chests and how dense the maze was, but that was it.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of, you know, quite a few of my other games are like that as well. A game like Inside of Starfield Sky required a ton of tuning and adjusting and tweaking and balancing and so on. Pretty much separate from the themes, most of it.
Yeah, I was going through the, you know, the various change logs of each iteration and yeah, taking a look at
through like 16 revisions.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, that leads into another thing I was thinking about. I mean, when you put a game out, you put it into people's hands for the first time, and I'm assuming sometimes things appear that you didn't even really expect. And something like Inside of Starfield Sky, what were some of the big surprises once an outsider got their hands on it?
Well, I mean, I knew that the game was, you know, it's a procedurally generated game. So that means, you know, I can't really play test. It's not like I could play test every level myself. It's sort of like, well, I don't really know what's truly going to come out of the system, or what could really, you know, is there a place where the player could truly get stuck, or really could be impossible to get through, or who knows what's going to happen, right? So I needed play testing, and that game needed a lot more play testing than pretty much anything I had done before. I mean, with Sleep is Death, it was like UI issues were the only thing, right? I basically knew how I wanted it to work, and the UI just had to work smooth enough and not have bugs in it. This game, it's like this huge procedural space to explore, and I just don't have, you know, I don't have the manpower myself to do it. So so playtesting was a big part. And in fact, you know, the game didn't come out until version 13. So it went through a ton, like probably a couple months of lots of people. I think over 50 people playtested it and submitted. I built a recording feature into the game, which is still in the shipping version. So every time you play, it's recording your game into a folder, which is just recording your keystrokes and mouse movement, and then playing those back when someone goes to watch it. And it's just pretty small text files that get saved. And so people were emailing those to me, and then I could watch their games and, like, kind of slap my forehead about, oh, you know, it really helped me iron out the tutorial for the first sort of part of development. It's like, oh my gosh, that's why they didn't understand. Oh, now I see what they thought, you know, and got me through. It took me like, I don't know, 6 iterations to get a good working tutorial that worked for everybody and didn't let anybody fall through the cracks of understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, it was people started getting really into the game and playing very deeply, and then all these other weird kind of things emerged. Like, oh, if I play this way, I can grind away on this in this particular way, and then, you know, there was one guy in some earlier version of the game figured out how to build up heart power-ups to the point where they went off the scale in terms of like how many digits of level they were.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
He was getting like level 1 million, literally level 1 million heart tokens, building them up through some exponential blow-up process. And then once he had those, he was basically invincible, right?
Mm-hmm. We were discussing this a little bit in the email that I sent you after I wrote my thing on it. And I was wondering, what is there a temptation to just kind of leave those exploits in and let people find them? Or is the impulse to always try to one-up people who are looking to get around?
The arms race?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I pretty much am... Yeah, I don't want those things to be in. You know, those aren't things that I wanted. You know, they're not things I wanted someone to discover. I didn't know about them myself. And once I saw, I guess I sort of thought, oh, well, people will be able to build up really big power-ups, you know, eventually. But in combination with the way the hearts work, you know, a lot of the other power-ups kind of scale on a curve, right? Because there's, like, for example, the spread power-up. If you just if every level of spread power-up added one more bullet to your spread, well, then once you get to, like, you know, level 50 or something, it becomes ridiculous, right?
Diminishing
returns. Or level, you know, if it was unlimited and you could have 500 bullets coming out from each shot, it would just grind your graphics card to a halt. So and, like, bullet speed is another one where bullets can only go so fast before they start actually going through walls because they jump an entire tiles width in one time step. Bullet rapid fire, you can only have a bullet coming out every frame. You can't go any faster than that, so you can only have 60 bullets a second. There is a hard limit there. So there's a number of the power-ups just have natural hard limits to them where you just, like, either a computational limit or just a fundamental limit. Like, you can't fire faster than 60 shots a second. So I had to figure out how to map an unlimited power-up space. Like, well, you can obviously keep upgrading these power-ups to a limited spectrum. So they're on a curve, right? So at the beginning, you know, as you keep picking up, like, rapid fire power-ups, your bullets get, you fire faster and faster and faster, but then the rate of additional firing faster slows down, and it's asymptotic, so you can keep improving forever, but the improvements get smaller and smaller. But hearts weren't that way, right? Because it was pretty natural. Like, okay, yeah, heart power up. Each one is worth one hit.
Yeah, seems logical enough at first.
Yeah, and so that system kind of collided with the heart power-ups in a way that the initial way of going down inside power-ups and building them up exponentially collided with the way the heart power-ups worked, in that they weren't on a curve. And so there was this motivation to get as big a, you know, big of heart power-up as you could, in a way that just broke the game, right? And the guy basically said, oh, so I really was trying to do this. Oh my God, I got a million heart power-up. Like, that was so fun to do. But then after he did it, the game sucked for him from there on, right?
Yeah.
It's like, I'm just flying through levels. I'm just walking through. I don't care. Like, I'm up to level 300 and it didn't matter. You know, this sucks, you know? I mean, basically, you know, these are game... People try to break the game, and then after they break it, they don't enjoy it anymore, right?
I find it interesting that you are kind of... You're taking it upon yourself to save that type of person. Like, I could easily see you saying, well, you know, don't do that thing. Don't ruin the game for yourself.
Yeah, because it's your fault.
Yeah, it's a much more... I would say, you know, not paternalistic in a bad way, but more like paternalistic and truly like a protecting people,
like
type
a guardian of
way.
No.
So what it is that this is what we do when we play games, right? This is playing games, and this is the only thing that we do. This is our activity when we play games, is we try to break games. I mean, that's what it's all about, right? Trying to find some strategy, like even in a two-player game like chess. If you found some way to move the pieces around the board in a way that would trap somebody, right, in a way they weren't expecting, would you do it or not? Yeah, you do it. You're trying to win.
And then rub their face in it.
Well, no, I mean, it's not about rubbing. I'm not talking about, like, gloating or pride or anything.
Yeah.
It's just like, you know, we set out to, when we play a game, to sort of, like, understand the system and figure out how it works and figure out how we can, like wrangle this system to let us, you know, achieve whatever goal has been set out for us, right? And... So that's what it's all about. And if you say, well, when you, you know, find some way that, you know, completely breaks the game, I mean, that's sort of a big victory on the part of the player. That's what the player's trying to do. So you don't want to let the victory be that big, game-breakingly big, or else the game is totally unbalanced, right? So, you basically are designing for that, right? And you want to have the sort of, I mean, I guess my friend Frank Lance says that's one of the sort of secret attractions of, like, puzzle games like Bejeweled or Tetris or My Game Primrose or whatever, or Drop 7, is that, you know, we're trying to, when we play and we play obsessively, there's sort of this hope, this fantasy that we're going to find a way that this system must be broken. There must be some way to exploit this, you know, and players, I mean, in My Game Primrose, I also had a game recording system in that. Where people who are posting stuff to the high scoreboards have, you can watch their games. And very early on, you know, immediately people found things I wasn't expecting, ways to play forever, one point at a time until they got a million points. You know, it's like, whatever they can find, that's what they'll do. So I'm not really trying to save them from themselves. I'm just acknowledging that that's what game design is, really.
Along the lines of the changes you've made throughout the process, I want to talk about the changes you made in the latest update, because they feel, especially the flag system, they feel like a very thematic change. And I don't know if that was something you intended or what sort of pushed you to implementing the flag system and the music that you create when you're using that flag?
Right, right. So I was struggling with this issue of, you know, this is this infinite space to explore, right? And there's this sort of question of meaning, right? Where you're like, okay, it gets harder and harder, and you kind of want to go higher and higher to kind of see what's up there or whatever. But there's this sort of, I mean, it's, you know, the game is sort of about emptiness and loneliness in a certain way.
Yeah.
But it was, I guess, kind of too much, slanted too much in that direction away from what I really wanted it to be about. In that, there was also just sort of fundamental issues of player motivation and so on. Because if you know, you got up to level 25, you would feel like, okay, I got to level 25. And you might tell your friend who was also playing the game that. And that wouldn't really mean anything to them because that was your own unique set of levels, you know, 1 through 24.
Mm-hmm.
And if your friend was struggling away at level 17, he might think, oh man, well, you must have had an easy level 17.
Yeah.
My level 17 is impossible. You know, that's why you got to level 25. You can't really compare progress. It doesn't really, you know, getting someplace in the game doesn't really mean anything because it's all a random roll, you know. And I was also, when I initially designed the game and thought about it, I was sort of thinking about permadeath and thinking about Spelunky and roguelikes and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And those games use procedural generation because they want to put you back down to level one again and have you go through everything without feeling like you're repeating, right?
Yeah.
And in my game, I had procedural generation and I ended up with a totally different death system. So I didn't ever force people to start over from the beginning. So there was no reason for things to be different every time. They were just sort of different every time because that's what my procedural system was doing. And it turned out that being different every time kind of removed meaning from the game because, you know, your level 25 is different from my level 25 and we were totally alone as we played this thing. And so then I realized that procedural generation could be used for something else. It can be used to make an infinite space, right? Which is what I really was using it for without realizing it, sort of. So then I decided to focus on that and then, you know, switch everyone to the same seed so that everybody in the world is going through the same infinite space. Which seemed really interesting and beautiful to me in a different way than it had been before. It was like, before it was like, oh, everyone has their own unique thing, and that's kind of beautiful. But it seemed kind of more beautiful to kind of be exploring this mysterious, infinite space that you kind of know. It was more, I guess, when I think about the universe and our smallness within it and so on, it's partly because it's everyone's universe, right?
Yeah.
And when you're the first two people ever to set foot on the moon, that's, you know, that's very meaningful because there's all the other people waiting back on Earth, right?
Yeah.
Something about that. And that they could come later or that they're thinking about you and they're thinking about that space too, even though they haven't been there yet.
When you find that permanent flag marker, there's a
right.
moment. Yeah.
Okay. So then I had this system where, you know, okay, everyone's playing in the same space, but that's beautiful to think about from a design perspective, but almost no player would actually realize that and notice it, right?
Yeah.
You know, it was just that you're all playing in the same space, and it's in the notes. that's the only way. Yeah. So
I was telling George, like, I was like, okay, look for my flag. It's green and red, and it sounds like this. Dun, 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 dun.
So yeah. So then I was trying to think of ways to sort of, is there going to be a leaderboard? I didn't know. Some of that stuff is just a really poor aesthetic fit. And so I came up with this idea of these flags that would sort of. I mean, I guess you guys are talking about the music a lot, but in a very sort of quiet, understated way. It's not like you run around a level and see someone's gamer tag.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Or, you know, there's not even room for anything thematically breaking in the flags. You know, I originally was going to do 6x6 flags, but then I realized you could make a swastika in 6x6.
Ooh,
you know?
Yes.
So then
smart,
I reduced it.
Jason.
I reduced it down to 3x3 because it basically makes it is impossible to represent anything in a 3x3 grid of pixels, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that it makes it just these little kind of patterns that you run into and you wonder who they are. You can't even like put your initial in it. You know, I couldn't really even make a J you know, in my flag or anything. And definitely not a picture of anything. And so,
of a response? I mean, because it seems like the industry is really into the idea of social stuff. Everything is leaderboards, you know, Facebook, very explicit connections. And was it also something, was this also... you know, a project to show like an alternative way of doing that, you know, doing a social game?
Yeah. I mean, basically, you know, the default way of doing this, which everyone is using the same system, which is just so strange to me. It's like, you know, with the achievements on the Xbox Live Arcade or trophies. I mean, they just have different names for the same thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they also have these things where you can compare your achievements against your friends, compare your statistics against your friends and your gamer friends. You know, all these platforms, Steam, Xbox Live Arcade, PSN, they all have the same system, basically with different names. And it just kind of seems, and they all claim, oh, our gamers love these things. Maybe I don't know how they know they love them. Maybe because so many trophies posted or whatever. I don't know. I guess when I talk to people who actually play games, I never hear anybody talking about them. I never hear anybody saying, you know, achievements are awesome. I just don't, you know. So it just seems like this thing that just kind of got picked up and everyone ran with because everyone else was doing it, and certain game players respond to it, I guess. But I don't know.
It's something that you can. It's something that people can measure.
It just felt like a really poor fit for the kind of issues definitely. That I was dealing with in my game. And there's this other big problem. Like, if you, we don't need to get off on this tangent too far, but basically these things can be hacked, right? So that people could post fake scores and fake achievements and so on. On the closed platforms, it's much harder to hack because you know, you don't really have access to the executable. You can't break in and see the line of code that is posting to the server and get the server's encryption key and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But on an open source game, where you can actually change the source code. I mean, you could go into my source code and change it so that you could post whatever to the whatever thing to the leaderboard you wanted, right? So I had to find a system that kind of couldn't succumb to that, which is why in my game Primrose there are playthroughs posted with each high score, because at least I could go to the leaderboard and verify whether someone's score is real or not, right? That was the motivation for putting those playthroughs on there. At least there was some proof, right? Prove that you got the score while I could watch your game. In this flag system, because there's no public leaderboard that you can go and look at separate from the game, it's like posting something on level 300 is only meaningful to the people who actually make it there to see it, right?
Yeah.
So there's not this sort of public banner where you'd want to get your name up there just to get your name up there. And also, the flags are tied to the specific random seed that generated the level and so on. So if you just posted something, some level 300, it might not be a level 300 that anyone actually discovers when they're exploring the tree.
Yeah.
You have to know the seed that's associated with the level, which means you pretty much have to get to the level to find out what that seed is. So it solved that problem. The other thing I wanted to mention was there's this amazing moon landing documentary called For All Mankind that was made in the 80s sometime with all this original footage from the moon landings.
It's a Criterion Collection, man.
Yeah, it's in the Criterion Collection. I just saw that like a month ago, right? This was while I was working on this game. So that's the big inspiration for this flag, you know, seeing these guys plant the flag on the moon, you know, and they were talking about, they talk, you know, it doesn't show any talking heads. It's just all this moon footage, a lot of it shot on film because they had film cameras up there with them. It's beautiful. And then it just has their being interviewed as older men thinking back about this experience, just their voices. And they talk, you know, I guess these are pretty smart philosophical guys, and they say some really beautiful things about their experience, and talked in particular about how what it's like to be the only two people walking around on a planet, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we're the only two people on this whole planet, you know? Like, what would that be like? And leaving that flag there. And then there's this scene where they're taking off from the moon with these kind of booster rockets that blast them up off the surface to meet back up with the command module. And the blast almost knocks the flag over that they left behind. You know?
Oh, man, what a bummer.
They left some kind of camera on the moon when they were taking off. So there's actually a shot of them taking off. From the surface of the moon. And you can see the flag almost blowing over in the blast.
It's still there. It would just be knocked over.
And at the end, you can see it pop back up. You know, so it's like it almost got knocked over. I don't know if they had it on a spring-loaded pole or what, but it kind of, you know, gets like almost knocked to the ground and then kind of springs back up. You know, it's like, oh, okay, the flag's still there. You know? Yeah. But the idea of going to some planet, you know, as the first person there, and maybe no one else will ever come back here, and like wanting to leave a flag there is just so, it's really interesting to me.
I think I also get this sense of mystery of like, well, maybe one level up, there's no one there, or I'll find a flag, or I'll find Scott's flag or something like that.
You know? Yeah, yeah. And it's also interesting that, you know, there's the sort of trunk of levels. If you just keep rising up, it's the sort of, if you think about the inside of Starfield Sky, what the structure is of all these infinitely linked levels, there's this kind of trunk up the center. If you just keep rising up, 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 you're going to go up through these same trunk of levels, you know, from level one up to level, you know, 2 billion or whatever the limit is.
Yeah.
And then off the sides, if you enter enemies or you get knocked down inside yourself or you enter power-ups, there's branches basically off this trunk. And so up the trunk, those are the most popular places to put flags. And I think right now, if I look at the server, someone has placed flags on the trunk levels all the way up to level like 200 or something. So that's pretty much taken care of, right? But even like all the way up through there, all these side branch levels, you know, have empty spots waiting, right? Just like go up to level 100 and then down inside this enemy that no one ever went inside, and there's going to be a place for you to put your flag, right?
Yeah. I think you get the sense too that there's evidence that you've been there, you know, that when you're done with the game, there'll be a piece of you remaining.
Right, right. And that's, you know, that's sort of the aesthetic point that I'm making, you know. So it all just felt like a really good fit for all the themes that I was kind of wrestling with. And yeah, and people seem to, I mean, I guess this is going back to this sort of cynical stuff about achievements. People seem to be loving it, right? It's like, I go to the server and look, and there's like, you know, like I said, people have only placed flags on the trunk up to level 200, but there's like currently 4,000 flags placed on different levels. Like 4,000 levels have flags on them. You know, that's not 4,000 flags that have been placed and replaced. That's like, you know, 4,000 unique levels off on the side branches and wherever have had have flags sitting on them. So people are, you know, obviously enjoy. And if you look at, I can look on the server end to see all the different flag designs that people have come up with. And some people have, you know, made really beautiful things. You know, it's so limited, but, you know, they still end up with these really little, beautiful little patterns and stuff. So
do you think some of those feelings are the same ones you were seeking to explore in a Chain World?
Yeah. Chain World is about sort of, yeah, leaving your mark in this place somehow, in this infinite thing that you're, you know, this game could be passed on forever, and people long after you're dead maybe even see like the remnants of the things that you did when Chain World, right?
And for folks that weren't familiar with it was something that Jason came up with at GDC, a Minecraft world basically that is passed from person to person without any explicit communication between the people.
Right, so it's one person plays Minecraft at a time, and when they're done and when they die, they pass the world that they've been playing in on to the next person in the chain. That person plays until they die, they pass it on, and so on. Over time, stuff builds up that people have been working on, but you don't really know why someone built something. You kind of come into the ruins of what they built and try to imagine what they were trying to do, what they were trying to tell you through these blocks that they had placed, and so on. You know, inspired by, you know, ancestry and our predecessors and what they've left behind for us, inspired by things like Stonehenge and things that my grandfather did, and, you know, all the people that came before us, and also our thoughts about the people who are going to come after us and what we're leaving behind for them. So, yeah, I mean, it is about, I guess, yeah, so maybe, I can't remember, I think, yeah, I'm pretty sure the flag thing came after Chain World. So, yeah, so maybe some of my thinking from Chain World kind of got folded into that. To that late design modification of Inside of Starfold Sky, that's certainly possible.
I was thinking about you know, going back to the making a game based on challenge and mechanics, and thinking that it's this Inside of Starfold Sky is this very there's a lot of old school design about it. It reminded me of some of the older arcade games. Just for my own curiosity, are there certain arcade games you were thinking about in your head as you were making this, or maybe personal favorites of yours?
I don't know. I mean, I guess not so much arcade games as much as like some modern sort of trends in game design. Mm-hmm. You know, things like Spelunky and sort of the roguelike renaissance,
yeah.
Procedural generation and stuff were really strong influences.
Maybe it's like a Rorschach test thing, because I kept on thinking to myself, like, this is Robotron and Pac-Man combined, you know, that type of thing.
I mean, obviously, you know, it is a kind of an arena shooter. You know, like Robotron is just a pure arena shooter, two stick.
Yeah.
This had mouse aim. I've never really liked two stick shooters. Somehow, I find them hard. Like, I feel like the control scheme makes the game harder to play than it is actually. Right? You kind of like want to point to where you want to aim, but you gotta kind of do this kind of two-handed coordinated motion.
Mm-hmm.
And like you take a game like Robotron and you add mouse aiming and suddenly it becomes much, much easier, you know? So, and on top of that, it's not an arena shooter, right? It's like it's kind of this corridor,
yes,
maze,
yeah,
kind of shooter, which, you know, adds this whole different kind of tactical element to it, right? Where you can run around corners, you can pop out from behind obstacles, you can use the level geometry to dodge bullets, to direct your own bullets, and so on. And then, you know, there's this weapon combo, additive combo system, which I don't think I've ever seen anything quite. I mean, I was trying to do something unique, so I don't think I've ever seen something anything quite like it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, modern game design like Borderlands certainly, you know, has this sort of bullet point on the back of the box that there are a million guns in the game, right? Because they have some sort of procedural weapon generation system. So they don't ever give you access to the procedures. They don't let you build your own gun in Borderlands, at least not in the parts that I got to. But they still hand you guns and tell you what their attributes are. So I thought, you know, I thought that gun system in Borderlands was really interesting. And, you know, I wanted to build a totally flexible procedural kind of weapon system where, you know, it was really possible to add these powers together in a meaningful way, right? That, you know, heat seek plus bounce, what would that do? Mm-hmm. And once I saw it in the game, it was like, it made me like laugh, right? It was hilarious. It's like you get this like little bullet that kind of will dribble along a wall, almost like a bouncing ball, trying to get down. And then once it gets around the corner, it shoots down toward the target, you know? When I first saw it, I thought it was a bug, you know? I was like, what's that bullet? Why is it bouncing along the wall like that? Oh, it's got heat seek and bounce, you know? and I just, there's so many little funny emergent things that came out of the weapon system in that game. I still will play it now and find some funny little combo that's like, will make me laugh, right? It's like, so yeah, you know, I guess it's kind of like a mashup in some ways of, you know, I talked about what I wanted to do thematically, but that didn't really specify a particular challenge, right? It didn't, I wanted to have these nested levels. I wanted to be able to enter things and change them. But it didn't really specify what you were doing between entering things and changing them. You know, why would you want to enter something? You know, what's the challenge? What's the sort of overall challenge? That was sort of open, right? And so I basically thought about the game designs that had inspired me recently and kind of cobbled together a new novel kind of challenge system out of some of those ideas.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, the game uses, you know, like the recursion, procedural generation. I mean, that seems to be, as far as design concepts go, that seems to be the, you know, the obsession or the interest of many people in the industry right now. And I was wondering if you thought that this was a lasting, you know, kind of zeitgeist, or do you think that this is something that people will kind of move on from, or do you think this is here to stay? Like this is going to be the future of what people do in games.
Yeah, it's a really good question.
I guess it depends on your next game, right?
Yeah. Right. I don't think that I don't know. Maybe I'm going to do something with procedural generation. I haven't thought too much about my next game. I'm giving myself some creative breathing room. But I think that, you know, there's still this very delicate balance of all these other factors that go into, you sort of think Spelunky is a very clear formula, right? It's like, roguelike plus procedural, roguelike, which includes procedural generation, plus platformer, right? Oh, that's an instant, like, success formula. But if you go, it was so hard, you know, I sort of thought, oh, it'll be, I just kind of mash these things together and I'll make a good game, right? When I made Inside of Starfield Sky. But, you know, it took me, like, you know, probably 15 revisions. Even in the 16th revision, I was still refining sort of the core death mechanic and some other things, separate from this flag stuff. So even with those elements that seem interesting on their own, it takes a lot of work and a lot of balancing, a lot of very careful decisions and tweaking to actually make a game work really well. And I, throughout the process of making Inside of Starfield Sky, I kept going back and looking at Spelunky and trying to figure out why it worked so well, why I kept wanting to play again and again, you know, why I keep saying just one more game. And there's all these very little subtle things. I mean, I've asked Derek about it, and he kind of said, well, I don't know, I just pick good values, you know. It's like how likely it is to find a shop, for example, or how likely it is that the shop will contain a shotgun, or how likely it is that such and such will be there. No, I don't know, I just picked values that felt good, he said. So I guess he's a genius. But it's not just like an easy formula, right? I played the game Torchlight recently, at least I played the demo. And it felt to me like there's a huge opportunity there for something really awesome, but they totally flubbed it, right? It's like, basically they've got the difficulty tuned, so it's nothing but a grinding game. I mean, there's no, my 5-year-old played through, my 7-year-old, who sucks at games and, you know, hates games and won't play any game because he's scared of failing, played through the entire demo without dying once. And it's like, you know, and I was playing through, I'm like, my God, this is just, I'm just sitting here pressing a button the whole time. Like, I'm not making any decisions.
Yeah, I had
finally, I played on the hardcore level with permadeath, and I still played through the entire demo without dying once. It's like, well, why permadeath? You know, it's like, is this, I guess maybe after the demo, the game gets hard or something. But it's just like, you know, you got these procedurally generated caves and all this kind of cool stuff, but none of it ever really matters, right? And players rave about it, I guess, because they don't think about these things or something.
Well, plus, it's been a long dry spell since Diablo, so
people are getting desperate.
Well, I guess I've gone back and played Diablo. I didn't play it when it first came out, but I thought it was hard. Wasn't it hard?
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely.
Yeah, so the hardness is part of what makes the game good. It's not like you can remove the hardness and keep all the other elements and have something good, right? So, I don't know. I think that, you know, it's easy to sort of look at these things as formulas and just kind of blindly apply them, but it's much harder to make a really good game around them. And it's very easy, sort of a trap to fall into with procedural generation. It's like, you know, an infinite amount of content, but it's all boring or something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, and that was kind of a line that I tread on with Inside of Starfield Sky as well. By making it harder very early on in the development process to sort of, you know, compress this play from like going through the first 50 levels, you know, and finally getting to some stuff that was hard to like getting pretty hard in the 20s, you know, to sort of compress those interesting moments down more. I don't know if it's, I mean, I guess a lot of indies are attracted to it because, you know, content generation is the most expensive part or something.
Right.
Yeah. There's an economic side to it, definitely. It's just interesting how some things catch on structurally. Like, it's odd that to this day we have, like, the boss structure in video games, or something even like...
Don't have that boss structure in my video games.
Exactly, yeah. And your game stands out because of it, which is such a weird concept because, you know, the boss structure is this weird kind of, like, somewhat outdated concept from the arcades when it was more about, you know, trying to get more quarters and stuff like that. I mean, like, it's just a very odd what catches and what doesn't.
Right, right. I mean, I think there's a huge opportunity. It's like, you know, if Torchlight had been a real roguelike, I think it would have been amazing, right? I mean, it's like, I think people would have loved it, and maybe I'm wrong. You know, real roguelike with real permadeath and, you know, actually being hard and tough decisions to make all the way down and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Diablo was inspired by roguelikes, but it wasn't a roguelike, right? And so we still don't really have a high-polished, real roguelike game, you know, that I can think of. I mean, there's all these little kind of ASCII roguelikes and, you know, like very simple graphic roguelikes, but no one has really set out to make, like, you know, a AAA indie or AAA, you know, quality roguelike, right? I mean, I don't know. It's kind of like, it seems like there's a lot of things that are just sort of waiting for somebody to come along and pluck a low-hanging fruit.
Well, maybe after you take a break, you know, keep that on the back burner a little bit. You know, we've had you on for, you know, you've been generous with your time, so we'll have to wrap it up pretty quickly. But before
I should get going because I got another call. But
But we like to ask everyone that comes on the show, just, you know, generally, like, if there's any games that they've been playing recently that have stood out for good or bad reasons.
I've been playing Far Cry 2. I've gone back to Far Cry 2 and playing it more deeply, and it's really amazing in a lot of ways.
Yeah, Ben Abraham has been doing a good job keeping that game alive years after it's come out. Yeah.
Well, it's just, I don't know. I just, back when it first came out, I had a borrowed Xbox that I only had for a week or so, and so I didn't play it that deeply.
Yeah.
Now I'm playing it much more deeply and sort of understanding the systems and so on. You know, it's very, very tight. I think a lot of it is very tightly designed.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, really good. I mean, I don't know. I played a lot of first-person shooters over the years and found them to be mostly boring these days. But Far Cry is really interesting. So,
cool.
So that's what I'd recommend.
Everyone just once you're done wading through the infinite universe of Inside of Starfield Sky, just wade through the infinitely dangerous jungle of
the Heart of Darkness.
I've also enjoyed Super Meat Boy, so I've been playing that recently, and I'm on the very last level, and it's just impossible.
You're a stronger man than I.
I've gotten through every single level except the last one, the last boss level kind of thing, and it's incredibly hard, but it brought me to this sort of level of performance in a game that I've never really experienced before, almost like a ballet like performance in terms of how good I was at controlling the game by the end. It just forced me into, like, really learning the systems.
Absolutely.
Which was a beautiful experience. So I'd recommend those two.
Cool.
Awesome.
Well, thanks again for coming, Jason.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah, we appreciate it. And, you know, for folks that are more interested in Jason's work, Inside of Starfield Sky is the most current game, but you know, Jason, all your games are still readily available from your website, which we'll link to in the show notes as well. You know, people can check you out. And I'm assuming are you on Twitter, or are you one of the last holdouts that's avoiding it?
I do have a Twitter account. I don't Twitter very much. I use it mostly for announcing a new game when it comes out. So that means I tweet every 6 months. So it's just Jason Rohr, all run together. I did kill my Facebook account about 6 months ago.
Congratulations. So.
It's tempting. My finger's always hovering over the the little button.
Commit Facebook suicide. That's what it was called back when I was doing.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Well, thanks for having me on.
All right.
Forward to hearing the show.
I appreciate it. Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Every time we